Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk program. My name is Jack Brighton. Very glad you could listen today. As we all know, information technology, largely defined by the world of digital computers, is growing exponentially. And growing along with computer technology is the information that goes in it. A string of ones and zeros can represent anything: a word, a dollar amount, a sound, a moving picture. Thus, the information technology we call the Internet has become a medium of all media, enabling anyone to become both an information provider and a consumer on a truly worldwide scale. This sounds great in principle, but as we should know by now, it's not quite that simple. We can get all kinds of information, but the Internet is a two-way street. Insurance companies, and perhaps anyone with the know-how, can access our medical records online, for example. Records of what we buy, where we go, and many other details of our daily lives are now gathered by corporations that hope to better target us as consumers. New technology may give us a world of information, but it also gives others a world of information about us, perhaps much more than we would wish. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about how the new world of information technology may affect our notions of privacy and freedom, and we'll try to raise some important questions we need to be asking ourselves as citizens in a global digital economy. Our guest is a writer and scientist who has been thinking about these issues for some time. David Brin is the author of many books, including a number of science fiction novels and short stories. He has, in fact, won multiple Hugo, Nebula, and American Library Association awards for his science fiction books, which include Star Tide Rising, The Uplift War, The Postman, Earth, Infinity Shore, and his latest novel, Heaven's Reach. David Brin is also the author of a nonfiction book, which we'll talk about this morning, The Transparent Society, subtitled Will Technology Force Us to Choose Between Privacy and Freedom?, recently published in paperback by Perseus Books. In that book, David Brin highlights some of the choices we might make concerning the uses to which new information technology will be put and the impact those choices will play in shaping the future of our democratic culture. As we talk with David Brin, you are invited into the conversation. If you have questions or comments on the topic, those are welcome. You can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, within the 217 area code, 333-WILL, and toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-WILL. In addition to his writing, David Brin has been a consultant to NASA and has taught university courses in physics and writing. He has a PhD in astrophysics from the University of California and has done academic research on exobiology, or the search for extraterrestrial life. He lives in Southern California with his wife, two sons, a daughter, and, according to his bio, 100 or so demanding trees. Let's say good morning to our guest, David Brin. Hello.
Good morning, Jack.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure. The university in Champaign is wonderful. It's one of the great in the world.
Well, we certainly like it here. A lot of great resources, to be sure.
Indeed.
Well, let me just start with, you know, to ask you to talk about, in your book, it seems like you're trying not so much to answer a lot of these questions as to raise them for people.
Well, this is that's very perceptive. I am very often accused of recommending that everyone should all of a sudden strip down and go around naked. And in fact, the book is intended to raise questions, many more questions than provide answers. One of the things I do try to point out, though, is that this wonderful freedom and privacy that we experience today, we have a lot more privacy. Almost all the scholars in this field agree that we have a lot more privacy and freedom than our ancestors ever even imagined. Mm-hmm. That we owe it all to one very, very special trick, and that no other civilization ever managed, and that is the knack of holding the mighty accountable. Turning the light that they used to shine on us, back when we were peasants, of holding us accountable without us being able to hold them accountable, and turning it around and holding the mighty accountable. Now, who you call the mighty depends on your personal quirks. If you're a Democrat, you tend to worry about accumulations of too much power by corporations and the rich, aristocrats. If you're a Republican, you tend to worry about accumulations of too much power by snooty academics and faceless government bureaucrats. What we tend to forget is that we've been subjected to the world's greatest propaganda campaign. We see it in all the movies, and that is suspicion of authority. And it's good, mostly, because it teaches us to do this, to hold the mighty accountable, to such a degree that last year the country got a bit nauseated by the degree to which we held our highest public officials accountable. But that's the point is, it's better to err in the direction of knowing than it is to err in the direction of not knowing.
Well, this is something you point out in your book very clearly at the outset, and that is that we're in a, you know, perhaps almost unique historical period. This experiment we call democracy for the past couple hundred years in the United States, elsewhere around the world, where people do have choices, where they do have the ability to hold the people supposedly in charge of the government or whatever institutions that society depends on, to hold those people accountable for the way that they behave.
Yes, and the point is that we've profited from four great institutions that have brought us most of our wealth and our prosperity and our freedom. These are called accountability arenas, where accountability is applied. One is science, where both sides of an issue tussle it politely in academic journals, but it's an adversarial process of accountability. Another is the justice system, where it's prim, it's almost nauseatingly prim, with lawyers dotting every I and crossing every T. But you have to understand that the issues involved in the justice system are so serious that they have to make sure that every I is dotted. The third accountability arena is markets. Free markets, and this is where corporations, businesses tussle over who delivers the best product and services. And the final is democracy, which is messy, loud, opinionated, but it's how we all get to hold people the mighty accountable. These four accountability arenas are how we've done it. They're how we get great products, how we get a fair amount of justice for all. How we all participate in the judgments of what's going to happen next in our civilization. And notice that they all depend upon most of the people knowing most of what's going on most of the time. And that's all I'm suggesting we need. We don't need for everybody to know everything about everybody all the time. That's not what I mean by a transparent society. What we've currently got, most of the people knowing most of what's going on most of the time, is enough. And what I'm afraid of is that as we burst into the next century, people will panic over the internet and over the cameras and over the databases and move away from that general way of doing things.
It is very important, though, and I think, you know, reading your book, you would agree, that people understand these technologies and how they're being deployed and be involved in a democratic way in making decisions about them.
Oh, yes, and half of the book is about these new technologies that are swarming at us.
Right.
So let me give a couple examples.
Sure.
One is the proliferation of cameras. When I lived in Britain 10 years ago, they were just experimenting with a few CCD video cameras on streets with a lot of crime to cut the crime rate, reporting to the police. Now there are 500,000 of these cameras on the streets in Britain reporting to the police, and crime has gone down, and they're very popular with the public because you can go walking around now. And yet civil libertarians are right to worry. You know, it's the 50th anniversary of George Orwell's 1984.
Right.
Do we really want 500,000 and then 1,000,000? And then as the technology improves, the cameras are going to get smaller and smaller and cheaper and easier to deploy. Now, in America, things are being done differently. Timothy McVeigh, for instance, was caught because there were lots of different cameras run by different commercial entities, and the FBI had to either get search warrants or ask pretty please to get to see those pictures. I think that's a little better. But still, we're going to have to discuss what it means to live in a civilization in which a camera is going to be cheaper than a pen. And that's going to happen sometime in the next 10 years. And the cameras are flying. The Army is developing a little flying drone that an infantry lieutenant will be able to send to find out who's lurking behind that bush over there. Well, these are going to show up in Radio Shack very, very soon.
Right.
And what about the millimeter wave radar? Well, you know, we have the danger of plastic weapons that can go through our X-ray machines at airports. To the rescue comes millimeter wave radar. It can see through clothes, but then it sees the plastic weapon that you're hiding. It also incidentally sees your naked body. Now this will make air traffic possible in the next century, keeping us safe, but how are we going to decide who's going to be watching these images? You know, little old ladies? Or shall we make the whole system self-financing by letting people bid for the right to watch them? That's an attempt at humor.
Yeah, well, what you're suggesting is that as this technology becomes pretty widespread, it might make us pretty uncomfortable to know that some people will, you know, many people perhaps will have these things that can, you know, for example, look through our clothes. You know, well, this is something that has become almost a reality.
Exactly, and I'm not offering prescriptions or solutions, but what I am saying is that people are leaping too quickly at what I think are some foolish prescriptions and solutions. What's happened is there's a big, strong privacy movement, with capital S, capital P, strong privacy movement going on, especially in America. And they're rightfully concerned that we might be heading towards Big Brother or a civilization that would suppress eccentricity. Believe me, I'm fighting to preserve this civilization that protects eccentricity because I know that in any other culture, a big loudmouth like me would be burned at the stake very quickly. And Jack, you'd be soon right after me.
Probably.
But how do you defend it? On the left, the strong privacy movement wants privacy laws. A myriad privacy laws, bookshelves filled with privacy laws that prescribe privacy commissioners and armies of bureaucrats going around saying that bosses can spy on their employees in this way but not in that way, that doctors can know this about their patients and can't know that about their patients, basically policing what people may know, turning information into contraband. But the problem with that is that we're monkeys. If you tell somebody that he can't know something, all it's going to do is make him or her reach into his wallet and say, how much do I have to pay to get it? If you think the drug war has been a catastrophe, wait till you see what happens when you turn information into contraband. And on the right wing of the strong privacy movement, what you have is libertarians who want to unleash encryption, anonymity on the Internet. And they think that if we all go around in masks, trench coats and masks, that we'll all be sovereign, free individuals forever. And the problem with their prescription is that every time they tout an encryption standard, or an anonymity standard, within 3 years a bunch of amateurs break it. They smash it with amateur computers. Relying on secrecy has never worked for the little guy. Secrecy has always served elites. And if we get used to that notion, we'll understand that the little guy has been best served in an open society.
The surveillance camera issue is perhaps one of the most obvious ways of explaining this dynamic, it seems to me, where you have a nation filled with cameras. I mean, you've got a couple of different models, at least, on how those cameras can be used. In one case, you have the nation of Singapore, which has a very, very tightly controlled set of public surveillance cameras that sort of, you know, track, you know, and try to eliminate street crime. And, you know if you're standing on the street, you may be under observation by the government at any particular
time. You very likely are.
Exactly. And then another model which you suggest is one that may be evolving in the Western world, which is where not only the authorities have cameras trained at the citizens, but perhaps, well, and in many cases already, aimed back the other way at the authorities.
Well, I'm not recommending anything in particular, but I am putting out examples for people to chew on. And one is that if we ever do have police cameras, there should be a camera in the police control room that's on the Internet so that we all see what the police are looking at. In other words, as Juvenal asked 2,000 years ago, who will watch the watchmen? Quid ipso custodia custodiae, something like that. Who will watch the watchmen? The only answer that works is us. Not all of us, all of the time, and not fetishistically, but some of us, some of the time, just so they know that they don't dare abuse their power. That's that's what works now. It's how we keep the corporate heads and the aristocrats and especially the government officials under some degree of control. They know they can't get away with plotting too heavily against us. I call it the henchman effect. When you have an open society, you can prevent big conspiracies. You'll never prevent little ones, but you can prevent the really big ones that might take away our freedom simply by making it real easy for henchmen to betray the conspirators and go public, get rich, get a book deal, and become a hero. One example of this was Jeffrey Wigand a few years ago, who, until he went public with his information about the tobacco companies, everyone was convinced that nobody could ever take on the tobacco companies. Well, they look a lot less powerful now, and largely thanks to him, and he has $1 million, and he went through hell, and now he's a public hero. As long as we make it possible for henchmen to turn into whistleblowers, we'll be mostly safe most of the time.
So the issue of a two-way flow or openness in both directions is, you know, I guess the title of your book, The Transparent Society, essentially that seems to be your major thesis, that this might be an example of ways that we could deploy technologies that would allow for continued, maybe less privacy, but still, a large degree of democracy.
Well, a redefined notion of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
These supermarket scanners are making it pretty clear that what salad dressing you buy is going to be about as private as what color sweater you wear down the street.
Right.
But if we redefine privacy properly, we should be able to keep the privacy that matters most, our bedrooms, the private conversations we hold with those who were confiding our deep innermost thoughts. I have a chapter in my book about, you know, what is privacy and how deeply essential this core privacy is. But we won't be able to protect that core privacy if we cling to an illusion that we can prevent others from knowing everything about the vast majority of things about us. If we cling to that illusion, then we're going to go into this next century unarmed to defend ourselves. Basically, as Robert Heinlein once said, the only thing accomplished by big blanket privacy laws like that is to make the bugs smaller and to restrict the use of the new bugs and the new cameras and the new powers of vision to some elite. Do you honestly believe that if you pass a law against these little cameras that somebody's not going to have them? The rich, the aristocrats, a criminal elite, a technological elite, and of course the government? All you'll do is make sure that you don't get them.
I have a friend who works at a supercomputing center not too far from here, who is involved in what's called data mining and writing programs that are useful for this kind of work, and without going into too many details of his activities, it's real clear that there are many corporations out there that are trying to gather as much information about individual consumers as possible in an effort to target us as consumers, of course.
Yes, you can make it sound...
Orwellian?
Orwellian, until you realize that it's mostly... Most of what's going on is that they are nefariously picking up all this information in order to find out what we want and, drum roll please, sell it to us.
Right.
If you put it that way, perhaps it's not quite as vile. But what I do find eerie and worrisome is when some elite, like a corporation, has all this information and can scheme what to do about it, even if it's scheming to sell me stuff better. And I don't know anything about them. The whole notion that I'm trying to push in my book is that you have a right as a person to say, show me yours before I'll show you mine. And I'm all in favor of short-term privacy measures to try to protect the weak. I think the locations of battered women's shelters should be secret. I think you should be able to have confidence that your psychiatrist records are private. This will happen if we live in a mostly open society in which you can find out who's snooping psychiatric records. Or at least you can rely on a news media, you know, what I call social T-cells, error-correcting T-cells, to sniff out mistakes like that. Guys like Jack Brighton, to find out who's violating these trusts. The main thing to bear in mind is that cameras are expansions and extensions of our eyes. The databases are extensions of human memory. When you're walking down the street sometime in about 10, 20 years, you're going to be wearing a pair of eyeglasses, sunglasses, and they're going to constantly, actively be writing little pieces of information on the inside of the glasses for you alone to read. And if you want, or if the capability is there, you're going to be walking down the street, and it will scan people's faces, look them up in the National Face Registry, and put little subtitles of their name and maybe a little bio underneath them as you're walking by. Now, if you outlaw this technology, all that means is that the very rich walking down the street will be knowing who they're looking at, and you and I won't. But think about what this will mean. What this will mean is, well, you know, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, we all lived in little villages where you knew everybody. And the human mind, the human memory, was able to remember about 1,000 names and faces, maybe 2,000. In the future, we're all going to be part of a global village in which, as you're walking down the street, you will, in effect, be part of a village of 6 billion people, because you'll be able to get the recall, the memory from the database, and see with recognize their faces with these enhanced eyes. And you'll be able to go back to making business deals with a handshake like you could in the old village, because the people's reputations will be right there in front of you. Now, it's an eerie world, perhaps a little scary world, but it will have the one thing that will make that world safe and relatively comfortable and easygoing, and that's accountability. Now, the only other thing you need in addition to that is a sense of humor and tolerance, a sense of forgiveness, because we're all going to know a large amount about each other. And as some Republican legislators learned during the Monica Gate scandal, it's best not to throw too many stones when you live in a glass house.
A good moment to pause to reintroduce our guest and to invite callers. We have a couple people waiting to talk, and we'll get right to them. We're talking this morning during this hour, Focus 580, with David Brin, author of The Transparent Society, Will Technology Force Us to Choose Between Privacy and Freedom? You may have also seen a number of his science fiction works. He's a Hugo and Nebula Award winner. Multiple books that he's written have won those awards. We're taking your questions if you'd like to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller. This is a listener in Savoy on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Good.
Say, it sounds like what we're doing here is more or less just saying that we have to give up our constitutional rights to privacy just because the world's changing.
Well, can you point out to me the constitutional right to privacy?
Well, the Fourth Amendment.
Carefully
is very
the
carefully
of the government,
and it took these notions into measure 200 years ago. They're basic, and they reflect what human nature can come to whenever you give government officials too much immunity.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, and let's get a response from our guest, because this is an issue that Mr. Brin, you deal with in your book, certainly.
Yes. First off, there is no right to privacy in the Constitution itself. There are measures to hold government accountable and to reduce the power of government to invade our lives and to force government to leave us alone. None of these principles have been applied to corporations, because the Constitution says nothing about that. In fact, we have been expanding these rights over the years. We now have more quasi-constitutional protections of privacy than our ancestors ever had, largely due to the innovations of Justice Brandeis and some others. And they introduced the principle that essential privacy is the right to be left alone, not so much the right to police the contents of other people's brains and tell them what they may or may not know. There's a difference between the two. When we're thinking of these privacy issues, we have to bear in mind that there's a difference between the realistic fear of what others can do to harm you and a more deep, primitive fear that others might know something about you.
My particular fear here is when people keep saying that we just have to accept this as inevitable, is that really what we're doing is granting people immunity and then hoping that that some civil action will come against them.
Well, I don't think you've been listening to anything I've said in the last half hour.
That's exactly what you're proposing.
No, I'm sorry. That's your interpretation of what I'm proposing. I, A, have not proposed anything, and B, I have been talking about accountability and holding the mighty accountable. That is my primary interest.
Well, you're saying that no law. You're saying that law shouldn't be passed to limit their immunity.
I'm saying that no law will prevent the mighty from knowing stuff.
Well, I kind of
however,
with you.
If we know stuff, we can prevent them from actually doing harm. And that is actually what... Look at some years ago, there was something called the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Lyndon Johnson, it was apparently faked. Lyndon Johnson went to Congress and got the Gulf of Tonkin resolution based upon an almost completely faked incident that went on North Korean boats attacking our fleet off North Vietnam and causing a huge moral emotional response and resulting in permission to go into a disastrous war. Do you know what would happen today if that were tried?
It's called the War Power Act. Would inhibit the president and
the War Power Act has never
the War Power Act.
The War Power Act has never inhibited anybody.
Stopped this Kosovo thing from escalating because Congress threatened to withhold funding based on the War Power Act.
Well, this is a little separate issue here, but
I guess basically
is that Kosovo was not impeded one bit by the War Powers Act. What happened was what would happen if the Gulf of Tonkin stunt hoax was pulled today, is that hundreds of sailors would be on the internet to their homes saying it never happened. That's what I call the henchman effect. If you can be sure that public officials or people, underlings, lower executives in corporations, that nobody can count on their henchmen not to become whistleblowers, then we're safe. Caller, I think your instincts and mine are almost identical. I just wish you understood what I was driving at here. Accountability is so, so important. It is more important than making sure that nobody else knows what salad dressing I buy.
Well, let me exercise my de facto powers as referee here and ask Mr. Brin to talk a little bit more about this issue of accountability. In particular, I want to ask you to describe the accountability matrix, which you elucidate in the book, and in particular as it deals with the information tools that are coming into widespread use.
Well, what happens is, in our ideal world, the little guy is left alone, and the mighty who might try to oppress us, as they have in every human civilization, human beings can be trusted to rationalize that if I were king, I'd rationalize I can be trusted with power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jack, I'm sure you'd be a great tyrant or king, because you'd be one of the noble ones. But we all tell ourselves I can be trusted with power much more than my enemies can be. Well, that's scary and it's a bit dangerous.
Sure.
What we've developed in our civilization is a sliding scale. If your recent court decisions have indicated that if you send a news camera along with police and they bust down the doors of a house, and this is not a public figure, the police can be sued, because we believe that if you're not a public figure, you haven't put yourself in a position that demands so much accountability. Whereas if you're a public figure, You've already sort of agreed in advance that we can look at you. This actually makes a lot of sense because it means that we might be able to have our cake and eat it too in the future. We might be able to have a fair amount of privacy for average people in the future while getting the accountability that makes sure that public officials, aristocrats, the wealthy, corporations, that they all get the healthy doses of light and accountability that they need in order not to oppress us.
The issue of how we use this technology or prevent its use is a big area that we're going to have to kind of grapple with through whatever legislation we're going to deploy to deal with these technologies. And an example, maybe we can use this as a way of sort of illustrating the general problem, is for example, with regard to the internet, the Communications Decency Act, which tries to prevent certain information from getting to certain people, How do you sort of sort out how to do that, whether it's going to be effective, and if there are going to be countermeasures taken by various people and so forth?
Well, you raise a very good point. And some people say that I'm a technological fatalist because I don't believe you can pass laws against technology. Well, my response is show me which technologies have really been effectively suppressed. And then show me how you're going to keep the elites, those who can keep secrets in this new world, from using these technologies, even if they're against the law. I mean, the criminals are already doing it. The CIA does it. The point is that we're going to have to show real agility in the future. If you want to protect your kids, the best way to protect your kids is by arming them with the ability to say, "My daddy says I shouldn't look at this stuff yet. I am a strong enough kid to be able to say no." It sounds like just say no in the old drug war, and to an extent it is. We have to strengthen our kids ourselves, whether it's with old-fashioned moral values or with long, long talks about the pros and cons of certain kinds of things. You can have a technology sieve that might block some of this stuff from entering your home, but in the long run, they're going to see some of it at their friends' houses. We're entering into a new world in which we're going to have to create kids who are both tough and sensitive at the same time. And it's a challenge.
Yeah.
It is a challenge. I'm not going to downgrade how difficult it's going to be over the course of the next 30 years to deal with all this. But we are a brave people and a smart people, and we've taken on challenges before.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a chapter in your book that you talk about the human nature element of this, all this stuff that we're facing, and it seems to be an important one to talk about in addition to whatever laws, regulations, and technologies that those laws and regulations may relate to. There's a nice quote by Howard Rheingold where he says, "The locus of control must be in our hearts and heads, not in laws and machines."
Yeah, well, if you try to regulate this new world with laws and with machines, I'm not against all laws, privacy laws, and I'm not against all attempts to make the machines capable of filtering for us.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is, in the long run, we're going to have to keep control over our lives as individuals. And that is, ironically, how we get a civilization, by each of us thinking in terms of the word citizenship. That's the one thing that Kevin Costner got right in his movie version of my book, The Postman,
right.
Was the notion that citizenship really is something, it's a palpable thing. If we ever lost this civilization, we'd miss it terribly. Otherwise, his movie was, kind of sweet, kind of a little bit silly, kind of a little bit goofy.
Kind of a little long, too. But
yeah, kind of a little long. But it did convey that one element from my novel.
Yeah. Well, let me just say that we're about 15 minutes toward the end here, away from the end of the show. We're talking with David Brin, author of the book The Transparent Society, Will Technology Force Us to Choose Between Privacy and Freedom? We have a couple callers. I've been making wait probably too long. Let's go ahead and include them before we run out of time. Next up, listener in Urbana on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly say that people think of surveillance by the government, and they think of, well, if you don't engage in any illegal activities, what's the problem? But the thing they keep missing, and which to me seems far more important, is whether you're being surveilled by good governments or bad governments. I mean, you could transpose this whole argument to Nazi Germany, and if they have that kind of surveillance capability, the meaning of the good bad would be completely inverted.
Well, I think that's an extremely good point, and it raises one of the great paradoxes of our age. Think about the following two facts. They are obviously facts, and yet they just clash with each other and they make your brain hurt. It makes a paradox until you come up with a third fact. Let's try this out on you. In all of human history, no government ever knew so much about its people as the American government knows about the American people. Fact number two, no people in all of history have ever been so free. Now, if you combine those two facts, it is weird. It feels like a paradox until you add a third fact. In all of human history, no people ever knew so much about their government. Now, when you add that third fact, you suddenly start to see that it makes a certain amount of sense. How much the government knows is what enables it to either be to do a better job at whatever it's trying to do. The more it knows, the better a job it will do at whatever it thinks its job is. What determines what those jobs are? What determines what those jobs are is what we know, because then we can rap government on the knuckles and say, we don't want you to do that. Go do that other thing instead. So the direction that the government is heading in has to be determined by people who are knowledgeable, who know what's going on, who make sure that the government can't keep any great big grand secrets from us. And then whether or not the government is efficient, that's determined by how much the government knows.
But the trend is definitely in the other direction, where the government says that everything's a security issue, and they want things to be done, they want us to be transparent, but they want to resist the transparency. And I got to get going here, but I wanted to say one last thing. I think your problem is, and I'm surprised I'm disagreeing with you because I've read some of your stuff and it's really good, what I see is more like the situation in a corporation, where when you apply to a corporation, you've got to open up your entire history to them. You fill out long, give them as much information as they request. But within the corporation itself, and this is something that's been going on for years, and it's a privacy versus secrecy kind of thing. Within the corporation itself, salaries are secret. It's secret who applies for a job, and therefore the corporation, can engage in any kind of nefarious deed it wants to, because over all these years, despite all the laws, and all the politicians, no one's ever been able to knock that down. I'm afraid the same thing's going to happen if we allow the government to surveil over us.
Well, I think you raise very good points. When you say that the government is getting more secret, however, I have to disagree. Overall, our ability to look at government and see what it's doing has improved over the years dramatically. But you are right in that there will always be a human urge on the part of government officials, all government officials, even those with good intent, to try to hide this, to try to hide that, because we're running against human nature. Any official, any high person with power is going to rationalize secrecy and tyranny in some level. And so that's why we have to constantly apply the light of accountability and live in a civilization where these tools are in the hands of citizens. Now, when you talk about corporations, Jack Stack wrote a book called The Great Game of Business, in which he shows that those corporations that are most open with their employees get benefit from those employees criticizing and finding ways to improve the business. There's been a huge investigation of this concept, and it's been proved to work tremendously well. And yet, why do corporate executives flee from it as fast as they can? Most of them, because of the same thing I just spoke about. If you are a monkey and you're given some power over other monkeys, you're going to want to blind the other monkeys and see as much as you can. That's human nature, and that's what we have to prevent. That's what we have to prevent.
Very good. We have a couple of the calls waiting in just about 5 or 6 minutes left. We'll try to get them both in. We'll go next to a listener in Urbana on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, Jack. This is David.
Yes.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Well, I'd like to agree with everything that David has been saying. I don't think you can really stop technology. It's already off to a pretty good start. I work at NCSA, and I've worked with a lot of different companies, and I've seen that companies are collecting all data that's scanned at all the scanners, and companies are selling scanned data to other companies, inevitably trying to make a huge database of all scanned data. And, of course, there are people looking at these histories of purchases and trying to infer all sorts of things. To make matters worse, you're starting to see a lot of commerce over the Internet, and all Internet activity is logged. How much time you spend on each page, what, you know, your sequence of clicks, all that can and is being stored. And I really don't think you can stop technology. But at the same time, I think that you can use technology to try to put a cap on decision makers and trying to make sure they don't go, you know, too far astray. I personally think that all major decision makers, you know, should be monitored 24 hours a day in sight and sound, and, you know, maybe having that very private. But, you know, when they need to be investigated, I'd like to see everything that they said and everything that they've done, because, you know, how else can you really fight, you know, high levels of corruption?
Well, that is, of course, the deeply American instinct that was expressed during Monica Gate. Notice that the American people thought there was nothing wrong with disclosure. They wanted to know what Clinton was doing in case it was something that would hurt their vital interests. But when they found out that it was just a bit of sleaze, what their instincts were to say, we value his services as an administrator, give him a stiff slap across the wrist and end this. They did not want to see vindictiveness. In fact, we raised our moral standards slightly over any previous human civilization, because in all other human civilizations, it was simply admitted that power is Viagra, and that men who have power have pumped up libidos. We actually said, as a people, please don't do this. It's too bad that some think that the slap of the wrist that we delivered means that we have low moral standards, but in fact it means we've upped the ante a bit. I think that we can have some control over these corporations getting data about this, about us, but I think we'll only do it if we live in a world of openness in which we can get the corporation's henchmen to whistleblow for us and tell us what they're doing. Tell us what the corporations are doing with all this data, and then at least we can maybe charge them something.
Yeah, I'm all for vigorous enforcement of the laws. I mean, there's plenty of information crime going on all the time. I'm amazed at like, most recently, the huge databases of MP3 recordings that are being amassed. That's all illegal, but nothing's stopping it. You know, I mean, recording industry doesn't have any privacy because it can be copied, stored, moved around so easily now, all because of technology.
Well, I have, I live by copyright. And believe me, I'm not urging everyone to go and download and steal my book and spread the information everywhere. I think that the patent laws and copyright laws were invented as ways to get people out of an underground economy and sharing their innovations in the open where they get a fair price for fair goods. And unfortunately, this whole new trend towards trade secrets is in the, going in the opposite direction. And the worst thing we could do for our economy and our civilization is to create a huge underground economy in contraband information. It's a very thoughtful question, sir.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, we should spend more supporting public institutions like the National Science Foundation, like the university systems, all of these people that do relatively open things, you know, with money, as opposed to corporations that do totally closed things.
Corporations are useful, too. They're that fourth accountability arena that I spoke of, and that's open markets. But in all four accountability arenas, the most important thing is that most of the participants know most of what's going on most of the time so that they can make good decisions in playing the great game. The adversary.